Hello and welcome to the reading of the Associated Press. My name is Donna Frano and today is Wednesday, April 8th, 2026. We will start with international news. This article is entitled United Arab Emirates says it is firing at incoming Iranian missile barrage. This has been written by Bassam Baru, John Gambrell, Sami Magdi, and Sam Metz. The United Arab Emirates said Wednesday afternoon that its air defenses were firing at an incoming Iranian missile barrage. The announcement came hours after Iran, the U.S., and Israel reached a two-week ceasefire in the war. The UAE did not elaborate on where the attack was happening. Iran, the United States, and Israel reached a two-week ceasefire Wednesday as U.S. President Donald Trump pulled back from his threats to destroy Iranian civilization. But questions emerged over what happened to be dueling proposals to halt the region-wide war and reopen the Strait of Hormuz, with Iran insisting it would charge tolls to passing ships and continue to enrich uranium. Trump then suggested American warships would be hanging around the waterway through which 20% of all oil and natural gas passes in peacetime. That could be a potential flashpoint as the days go on. Trump initially said Iran had proposed a workable 10-point plan that could help end the war he launched with Israel on February 28th, but he later called the plan fraudulent without elaborating. Trump has said ending Iran's nuclear program was a key war goal. Israel backed the U.S. ceasefire with Iran, but Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Wednesday it won't stop his country's fight against Hezbollah in Lebanon, which continued through the morning. That contradicted comments from Pakistan, a key mediator, which said the ceasefire included the fighting in Lebanon. Israel's military said later that Wednesday that it continues fighting and ground operations against Hezbollah. Pakistan said that talks over cementing a peace plan would begin in Islamabad as soon as Friday. Pakistan also said the ceasefire was to begin immediately, while Iran launched attacks on Gulf Arab states and Israel soon after. Oil prices fell and stocks rose as Asian markets opened Wednesday after the 11th-hour agreement to reopen the strait. And the streets of Tehran, pro-government demonstrators screamed, "Death to America, death to Israel, death to compromisers," after the ceasefire announcement and burned American and Israeli flags. The chants underscored the anger animating hardliners who had been preparing for what many assumed would be an apocalyptic battle with the United States. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said passage through the strait would be allowed under Iranian military management. It wasn't clear whether that meant Iran would completely loosen its chokehold on the waterway. The plan allows for both Iran and Oman to charge fees on ships transiting through the strait, according to a regional official who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss negotiations they were directly involved in. The official said Iran would use the money it raised for reconstruction. But that would upend decades of reliance on the strait as an international waterway free for transit and will likely not be acceptable to the Gulf Arab states, which also need to rebuild after repeated Iranian attacks targeting their oil fields. Big money will be made. Iran can start the reconstruction process, Trump said on social media. It's not clear what happens when the 2 weeks of the ceasefire ends. There's little public sign that Iran and the United States had resolved disagreements over the fate of Iran's nuclear program, its ballistic missiles, or its regional proxies, among the issues that the United States and Israel cited as justifications for launching the war. In addition to control of the strait, Iran's demands for ending the war include withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from the region, the lifting of sanctions, and the release of its frozen assets. All those likely are non-starters for Trump and potentially other Western nations. Iran's chokehold on the strait roiled the world economy and raised the pressure on Trump to reach a deal. Since the war began, Trump has repeatedly backed off deadlines just before they expire. In doing so again Tuesday, Trump said in a social media post he had come to the decision based on conversations with Pakistan Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif and General Asim Munir, Pakistan's powerful army chief. A senior Israeli official said the United States had coordinated the ceasefire with Israel in advance and said Israel's government credited the massive crushing of the regime's infrastructure with securing the agreement. Speaking on condition of anonymity because they were discussing private diplomatic conversations, the official said Wednesday said Washington had committed to pressing for the removal of nuclear material and dismantling of Iran's ballistic missile program. Missile alerts were issued in the United Arab Emirates, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Kuwait after the ceasefire announcement. A gas processing facility in Abu Dhabi was ablaze after incoming Iranian fire, officials said. More than 1,900 people had been killed in Iran as of late March, but the government has not updated the war's toll for days. In Lebanon, where Israel is fighting Iran-backed Hezbollah militants, more than 1,500 people have been killed and 1 million people have been displaced. 11 Israeli soldiers have died. In Gulf Arab states in the occupied West Bank, more than 24 people have died, while 23 have been reported dead in Israel and 13 U.S. service members have been killed. Our next article is entitled, How Trump Went From Threatening Iran's Annihilation to Agreeing to a 2-week ceasefire with Tehran. This has been written by Amir Madhani, Will Weissert, and Josh Boak. President Donald Trump, over the course of a day, went from threatening Iran with annihilation to proclaiming that the battered Islamic Republic's leadership had presented a workable plan that led him to agree to a 14-day ceasefire that he expects to pave the way to end the nearly 6-week-old war. The dramatic shift in tenor came as intermediaries, led by Pakistan, worked feverishly to head off a further escalation of the conflict. Even China, Iran's biggest trading partner and the United States' most significant economic competitor, quietly pulled strings to find a pathway toward a ceasefire, according to two officials briefed on the matter who were not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on the condition of anonymity. The reason for doing so is that we have already met and exceeded all military objectives and are very far along with the definitive agreement concerning long-term peace with Iran and peace in the Middle East, Trump declared in a social media post announcing the temporary ceasefire about 90 minutes before his deadline for Tehran to open the critical Strait of Hormuz or see its power plants and other critical infrastructure obliterated. The president is set to meet at the White House on Wednesday with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. The emerging ceasefire and plan to reopen the strait is expected to be at the center of the talks. As the deadline neared, Democratic lawmakers decried Trump's threat to wipe away an entire civilization as a moral failure, and Pope Leo XIV warned strikes against civilian infrastructure would violate international law, calling the president's comments truly unacceptable. But in the end, Trump may have ultimately backed down because of a simple truth. Escalation could risk involving the United States in the sort of forever war that had bedeviled his predecessors and that he had vowed he'd keep the United States out of if voters sent him back to the White House. As Trump boasted about U.S. and Israeli military success over the last 6 weeks, he appeared to be working from the premise that he could bomb Iran into capitulation. Starting with the killing of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and the opening salvos of the war, he seemed to discount that the Iranian leadership could opt for a long, bloody war. The Islamic Republic over the last 47 years has repeatedly shown it's willing to dig in, even when it appears to America they're working against their own self-interest. The clerical leadership held Americans hostage for 444 days from late 1979 to early 1981 at the cost of the country's international standing. The mullahs allowed the ruinous Iran-Iraq war to go on for years, leaving hundreds of thousands dead. It stood by Hamas after the October 7th attack that spurred a war with Israel that would defang the Iran-backed group in Gaza, as well as Hezbollah in Lebanon, and created the conditions that led to the collapse of Tehran-backed Bashar Assad's authoritarian rule in Syria. Iran's leadership, battered and outgunned, exuded confidence that it could very well bog down the world's superpower in a costly extended conflict, even if it might not defeat a mighty U.S. military. Defense analysts largely agree that the United States military could quickly take control of the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow Persian Gulf waterway between Iran and Oman, through which roughly 20% of the world's oil flows on any given day. But maintaining security over the waterway would require a high-risk, resource-intensive operation that could be a years-long American commitment. Ben Knobel, executive director of the nonprofit Battle Research Group, said securing the strait would require the U.S. military to maintain control of about 373 miles of Iranian territory, from Kish Island in the west to Bandar Abbas in the east, to stop Iran from firing missiles at ships passing through the strait. It's a mission that Knobel said would likely require 3 U.S. infantry divisions, roughly 30 to 45,000 troops. This would be an indefinite operation, so, you know, think. Be ready to do this for 20 years, said Knobel, a retired Marine Corps intelligence officer. We didn't think we were going to be in Afghanistan for 20 years. We didn't think we were going to have to be in Vietnam as long as we were, or Iraq. The two-week ceasefire plan includes allowing both Iran and Oman to charge fees on ships transiting through Hormuz, a regional official said. The official said Iran would use the money it raised for reconstruction. It wasn't immediately clear what Oman would use its money for. The strait is in the territorial waters of both Oman and Iran. The world had considered the passage an international waterway and never paid tolls before. Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat of Connecticut, said after the ceasefire was announced that Trump was effectively giving Tehran control of the strait and delivering a history-changing win for Iran. The level of incompetence is both stunning and heartbreaking, Murphy said. The ceasefire announcement came after Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif urged Trump to extend his deadline by 2 weeks to allow diplomacy to advance, while also asking Iran to open the strait for 2 weeks. 2 weeks has become Trump's favorite interval to buy himself some time when making major decisions. Last summer, the White House said he decided about launching an initial bombing campaign against Iran within 2 weeks, only to have the president order airstrikes that he said obliterated Iran's nuclear program before the interval was up. Trump has also repeatedly used 2 weeks to set deadlines that ultimately led to very little during negotiations to end Russia's war with Ukraine, and even going back to his first term, suggesting he'd have major policy issues like healthcare solved over such a time frame. Trump has repeatedly made maximalist demands throughout the first 15 months of his second White House term, only to dial them back. The president backed off many of the sweeping Liberation Day tariffs he first announced in April of 2025 after they caused the financial markets to go haywire. Perhaps the most spectacular example came during a January meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos, where Trump insisted that he wanted the U.S. to take control of Greenland, including right, title, and ownership, only to switch course and abandon his threat to impose widespread tariffs on Europe to press the case. The pretext for backing down that time was Trump saying he'd agreed with the head of NATO on a framework of a future deal on Arctic security, even though the U.S. already enjoyed widespread military latitude in Greenland, which is part of the Kingdom of Denmark. The White House celebrated on Tuesday evening with aides crediting the U.S. military's prowess and Trump's maneuvering for setting conditions for the ceasefire. The success of our military created maximum leverage, allowing President Trump and the team to engage in tough negotiations that have now created an opening for a diplomatic solution and long-term peace, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt declared. She added, "Never underestimate President Trump's ability to successfully advance America's interests and broker peace." Our next article is entitled, "North Korea Fires Missiles Toward Sea After Ridiculing South's Hopes for Better Ties." This has been written by Hyung Jin Kim and Kim Tong-wan. North Korea fired multiple short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea Wednesday in its second launch event in 2 days, South Korea's military said, hours after a senior North Korean official released crude insults against Seoul's hopes for warmer relations. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said several missiles lifted off from North Korea's eastern coastal Wonsan area on Wednesday morning and flew about 150 miles each in a direction toward the North's eastern waters. It said an additional North Korean ballistic missile fired later Wednesday and traveled more than 435 miles off the North's east coast. South Korea's military said it maintains a readiness to repel any provocations by North Korea under a solid military alliance with the United States. It earlier said it detected the launch of an unidentified projectile from North Korea's capital region Tuesday. South Korean media reported the projectile, also likely a ballistic missile, disappeared from South Korean military radars after displaying an abnormal development in the initial launch stage. This indicated the launch ended in failure, according to the reports. The back-to-back launches came after North Korea made it clear that it has no intentions of improving ties with South Korea, whose liberal government has steadfastly expressed its hopes to restore long-dormant dialogue. On Tuesday night, Jang Kum-jol, first vice minister of Pyongyang's foreign ministry, said South Korea would always remain North Korea's most hostile enemy state. He derided South Korea as world-startling fools engaged in wishful thinking over a recent statement by Kim Jong-un, the influential sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. After South Korean President Lee Jae-myung expressed regret over alleged civil drone flights into North Korea, Kim Yo-jong late Monday praised him for what she called honesty and courage, but reiterated a threat to retaliate if such flights recur. South Korean officials responded by describing Kim Yo-jong's statement as meaningful progress in relations. Jang said her statement was intended as a warning. He cited Kim Yong-yang as calling South Korea the dogs affected by mange that blindly bark to the tune of neighboring dogs, as she criticized it for recently co-sponsoring of a UN resolution on the North's purported human rights violations. North Korea has refused to return to talks with South Korea and the U.S. and pushed to expand its nuclear arsenal since Kim Jong-un's diplomacy with U.S. President Donald Trump collapsed in 2019. North Korea has instead sought to strengthen ties with Russia, China, and other countries embroiled in confrontations with the United States. Last September, Kim Jong-un traveled to Beijing to attend a military parade alongside other foreign leaders and held his first summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping in 6 years. North Korea's state media said Wednesday that Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi will visit North Korea on Thursday for a 2-day trip. Earlier this week, North Korea said Kim Jong-un had observed a test of an upgraded solid fuel engine for weapons and called it a significant development boosting his country's strategic military arsenal. Missiles with built-in solid propellants are easier to move and conceal their launches than liquid fuel weapons, which in general must be fueled before liftoffs and cannot last long. South Korea's spy agency told lawmakers Monday the engine test was likely related to an effort to build a more powerful solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missile that can carry multiple nuclear warheads, according to lawmakers who attended the meeting. Experts say North Korea wants multi-warhead missiles to penetrate U.S. missile defenses, but they doubt Pyongyang has mastered the technology needed to acquire such a weapon. Our next article is entitled, Hong Kong firm files arbitration against Maersk, saying it schemed with Panama over a port takeover. This has been written by Candice Leung. A subsidiary of a Hong Kong-based conglomerate started arbitration proceedings against Danish logistics and port group Maersk, accusing the company of aligning with Panama in a scheme to take over its port operations on the Central American country's critical canal. The Panama Ports Company, a unit of Hong Kong CK Hutchinson Holdings, said in a statement dated Tuesday that Maersk AS had undermined a contract over the Hong Kong company's operations of ports at either end of the Panama Canal in order to pave the way for a new operator affiliated with Maersk to take over the Balboa terminal. The company said the arbitration will be held in London, but didn't explain what remedy it was seeking. In February, Panama's government seized control of the Balboa and Cristobal ports after the country's Supreme Court declared earlier that a concession allowing the Panama Ports Company to run the ports was unconstitutional. The ruling drew backlash from China. The Panamanian government later allowed subsidiaries of Maersk and the Mediterranean Shipping Company to take over operations at the two ports. Panama Ports Company started arbitration proceedings against Panama in February. In late March, it expanded its claims, saying damages have escalated beyond $2 billion. It said on Tuesday that its claim against Maersk is separate from its ongoing steps to hold Panama accountable for what it called anti-contract and anti-investor conduct. Neither Panama's government nor Maersk immediately commented. The legal actions could further complicate CK Hutchinson's initial plan to sell the bulk of their dozens of global ports, including the two Panama ports, to a consortium that involved U.S. investment firm BlackRock in a $23 billion deal. The sale plan, first announced in March of 2025, pleased U.S. President Donald Trump, who has alleged Chinese interference with the critical shipping lanes operations. But the planned sale apparently angered Beijing, and China's antitrust regulator last year said it would initiate a review of the deal. The parties involved in the deal have since been looking for ways to move forward with the sale, including considering plans to add a Chinese investor to the consortium. Our next article is entitled, Rwanda Tries to Protect Farmland in Africa's Most Densely Populated Nation. This has been written by Evelyn Musambi and Neji Bizumungi. The rhythmic sounds of construction muffle the thud of farmers' hoes on a chilly morning in Rwanda's capital, where new efforts aim to protect remaining agricultural land from relentless development in Africa's most densely populated country. 84-year-old Mugurusini Pura Sikara had been a farmer before she fled the country to Congo during the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Upon returning, she said her family's land, which had stretched across the hills, had been taken away for construction. She gestured toward Kigali's high-rise buildings. Now she grows maize and sweet potatoes on a piece of land the size of a small cottage, which she said is barely enough to feed her. "It is all I have," she said, looking warily at construction equipment on a ridge nearby. Now she has a measure of protection. Since September, Rwanda's government has been mapping agricultural land and using satellite imagery to track any development encroaching on farmlands and forest in a country where the population is expected to reach 22 million in a couple of years. Rwanda is striving to ensure food security amid the latest global pressures on farm inputs like fertilizer, whose prices have been rising since the Iran war began. The government has imposed fines of up to $3,000 and jail terms of up to 6 months on developers found to be encroaching. Some buildings in Kigali have been torn down, though people associated with them didn't want to comment for fear of government retaliation. The government now plans to incorporate drones for better real-time monitoring. Meanwhile, land use data from the mayor's office shows that the Kigali Master Plan has dedicated nearly a quarter of land, 22%, to agriculture. City authorities acknowledge that housing construction is attractive due to demand, but say future projections show that farming will be even more productive. They say the demand for food is also rising and believe that, with innovation, it can be grown on smaller pieces of land. While most of the food consumed in Kigali comes from other districts in Rwanda, farmland in those areas is shrinking too, a spokeswoman for the mayor's office, Emma Claudine Tiraganya, told the Associated Press. The government last year printed and displayed maps showing areas and districts across Rwanda that are designated for construction and reserved for agriculture. Tiraganya spoke of going into agriculture in an urban way. We will be able to show Kigalians that they can also do agriculture and be productive. The city administration, which has set up a greenhouse on its roof, requires developers seeking building permits to include green spaces and gardens in their design. Other approaches in Kigali include vertical farms, where vegetables and fruits such as strawberries are grown in stackable plastic containers. Christian Irakozi co-founded a local company, Iza Niza, or Grow Well, that sets up vertical farms in the city and describes them as scalable. The AP visited two of them at local homes and another that provides stocks to a grocery store. One grows 600 plants in a vertical row stretching about 50 yards along a perimeter wall. Irakozi described his work as a different way of thinking about farming, from traditional large-scale upcountry farming to something smaller, modular, and that anyone could really do. Through the use of locally available inputs such as manure and volcanic sediment in place of soil, Irakozi said farming should be adapted to lessen outside impacts. We really have to find ways to find our own solutions, whether through inputs like fertilizers or seeds. Some of these global events are always a reminder that we should definitely have some alternatives, he said. Elsewhere in Kigali, a group of young agronomists are training farmers to adopt technologies such as hydroponics to maximize productivity using water instead of soil. The population is increasing, yet our land is not increasing. We make sure that we find solutions that can help farmers to overcome that, and then they produce more, said one of the agronomists, Richard Bukyana. Bukyana agreed that solutions such as Rwanda's help to buffer from global events. African governments should start thinking how they can be self-sustainable, he said. Our next article is entitled, American journalist Shelley Kittleson has been released week after kidnapping in Iraq, Rubio says. This has been written by Kassam Abdul-Zahra. American journalist Shelley Kittleson, who was kidnapped from a Baghdad street corner last week, was released Tuesday, U.S. and Iraqi officials said. The development came after the powerful Iran-backed Iraqi militia Kataib Hezbollah said in a statement that it had decided to free Kittleson, who was abducted on March 31st. Its condition was that Kittleson must leave the country immediately upon her release. Two officials within the militia, who spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to comment publicly, told the Associated Press that in exchange for freeing Kittleson, several members of the group who had previously been detained by Iraqi authorities would be released. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio confirmed Kittleson's release in a statement early Wednesday. He said on X, "We are relieved that this American is now freed and we are working to support her safe departure from Iraq." Rubio thanked Iraqi authorities as well as the FBI and U.S. Defense Department and other U.S. agencies for their work towards securing Kittleson's release. According to one of the two Iraqi officials who confirmed her release before the U.S. announcement, Kittleson was free in the afternoon. The official who spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to comment publicly did not share her current whereabouts, but said that prior to her release, Kittleson had been held in Baghdad. In its statement, Kataib Hezbollah said its decision came in appreciation of the patriotic stances of the outgoing Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, without giving more details. It added that this initiative will not be repeated in the future. In Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, Kittleson's mother told a reporter who knocked on her door Tuesday that FBI agents were at her home. A number of people could be seen sitting at Barb Kittleson's kitchen table. Initially, she said that her daughter had not yet been freed, but when a reporter returned later, she said she did not know if her daughter had been released or not. No update from the Kittleson family was immediately available after Rubio confirmed her release. Carolyn Clancy, a spokesperson for the FBI's Milwaukee field office, declined to comment. Kitab Hezbollah had not previously acknowledged that it abducted Kittleson, although both U.S. and Iraqi officials had blamed the group. Kittleson, who is 49, had lived abroad for years before the kidnapping, using Rome as her base for a time and building a respected journalism career across the Middle East, particularly in Iraq and Syria. Like many freelancers, she often worked on a shoestring budget and without the protections afforded by large news organizations to staff. She had entered Iraq again shortly before her abduction. U.S. officials have said that they warned her multiple times of threats against her, but that she did not want to leave. Iraqi officials have said that two cars were involved in the kidnapping, one of which crashed while being pursued near the town of Al-Haswa in Babil province, southwest of Baghdad. The journalist was then transferred to a second car that fled the scene. Three other Iraqi officials said earlier Tuesday that attempts to negotiate her release had run into obstacles. The two Iraqi security officials and one official from the pro-Iran coordination framework political bloc spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak about the sensitive case publicly. According to one of the security officials, a member of the Popular Mobilization Forces, a coalition of Iran-backed militias that is nominally under the control of the Iraqi military, had been tasked with communicating with the abductors to secure Kittleson's release, but had run into difficulties in communicating with the Kitab Hezbollah leadership. The primary challenge is that the leaders of the Kitab militia, specifically the commanders of the battalions, are nowhere to be found. No one knows their whereabouts, and the process of establishing contact with them is extremely complex, the security official said. These leaders have gone underground, maintaining no active lines of communication out of fear of being targeted, they added. According to the officials, a message had been sent to the Kitab leadership to determine their demands in exchange for releasing Kittleson. Iraqi authorities were willing to release six Kitab Hezbollah members who are currently detained, most of them in connection with attacks on a U.S. base in Syria, they said. Kitab Hezbollah has previously been accused of kidnapping foreigners. Elizabeth Surkov, a Princeton graduate, student with Israeli and Russian citizenship, disappeared in Baghdad in 2023. After she was freed and handed over to U.S. authorities in September 2025, she said that she had been held by Kitab Hezbollah. The group never officially claimed responsibility for kidnapping Surkov. Iran-backed militias in Iraq have also launched regular attacks on U.S. facilities in the country since the beginning of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. And now we turn to our domestic news. This article is entitled, Trump endorsed Republican Clay Fuller wins Marjorie Taylor Greene's former House seat in Georgia. This has been written by Jeff Amy. Republican Clay Fuller on Tuesday won Marjorie Taylor Greene's former U.S. House seat in Georgia, turning back a Democratic challenge with the help of President Donald Trump's endorsement, despite uneasiness over the war in Iran. In a deep red district that Greene won by 29 points and Trump carried by almost 37 points 2 years ago, Fuller was on track to prevail by about 12 points with almost all votes counted. The result added to a string of special elections where Democrats performed better than expected, a track record that the party hopes will create momentum toward November's midterm elections when control of Congress hangs in the balance. In another election held Tuesday, a Democrat-backed candidate for the Wisconsin Supreme Court won by double-digit margins, growing the liberal majority there. Fuller insisted that his victory over Democratic candidate Sean Harris in Georgia was a testimony to Trump's staying power. They couldn't beat Donald Trump, and they never will, he told reporters in Ringgold, near the border with Tennessee, and I will be on Capitol Hill as a warrior to have his back each and every day. However, Trump's escalating rhetoric had some Republicans concerned, even in this deep red district. The president had set a deadline for Tuesday at 8 p.m., 1 hour after polls closed in Georgia, for Iran to reach a deal with the United States, saying that a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. However, he later announced a 2-week ceasefire to allow negotiations to continue. Acworth resident Jason McGinty said he was worried Trump was about to go too far and may be committing a war crime if he followed through on threats to bomb power plants and other infrastructure in Iran. He voted for Fuller to make sure the American First Party is still in place. Retiree Judy McDonald agreed with the president's decision to go to war, but was very anxiety-ridden over the conflict. Eventually, we will have peace and the Iranians will kind of come to a conclusion that they won't have a country if they don't stop the terrorism, she said. Fuller will serve out the remaining months of Green's term, bolstering the party's slim majority in the House, where Republicans control 217 seats to Democrats 214, with one independent. He'll have to face another Republican primary on May 19th to win a full 2-year term and could face a June 16th party runoff. Harris is already the Democratic nominee for November. Retiree Melinda Doyle supported Harris, so it sends a message to Trump and his cronies that people aren't happy, she said. The war was totally uncalled for. Trump is a liar. Everything he says is a lie, Doyle said, adding that Trump was wrecking relationships with countries that have traditionally been American allies. Harris, a cattle farmer and retired general who describes himself as a dirt road Democrat, stirred enthusiasm even among supporters who expected him to lose. I voted for the Democrat even though this is a very red district, and the Democrat has almost no chance of winning, said Michael Robards, a software engineer from Kennesaw who calls himself a center-right independent. He said he wants to see Trump policies roll back and the president again impeached. Georgia's 14th district stretches across 10 counties from suburban Atlanta to Tennessee. After losing to Green 2 years ago, Harris said his strong showing this time would be a stepping stone to November. We're going to beat him next time, Harris said on Tuesday in Rome, Georgia. Fuller said he withstood Democrats' best punch. The left did their best. They poured in millions upon millions of dollars, Fuller told reporters, and what you're seeing is the best that they can accomplish. Trump endorsed Fuller, a district attorney who prosecuted crimes in 4 counties, to succeed Green in February, boosting him over other Republican candidates in a crowded field. Green, once among Trump's most ardent supporters, had split with the president by criticizing his foreign policy and his reluctance to release documents involving the Jeffrey Epstein case. The president eventually had enough, saying he would support a primary challenge against her. Green announced a week later that she would resign. Outside of Congress, Green has continued to assail Trump. Trump was elected to go to war against America's deep state and to end America's involvement in foreign wars, she wrote on social media on Tuesday, not to kill an entire civilization while waging a foreign war on behalf of Israel, another foreign country. However, Fuller has backed Trump to the hilt, including the war, and has identified no issue on which he disagreed with the president. Trump reiterated his support for Fuller on Monday night and then again on Tuesday. To the great patriots in Georgia's 14th congressional district, get out and vote today for fantastic candidate Clay Fuller, who has my complete and total endorsement, the president wrote on social media. Our next article is entitled, Artemis II astronauts make long-distance call to the space station as they head home from the moon. This has been written by Marcia Dunn. Still aglow from their triumphant lunar flyby, the Artemis II astronauts made more history Tuesday, calling their friends aboard the International Space Station hundreds of thousands of miles away as they headed home from the moon. It was the first moonship-to-spaceship radio link-up ever. NASA's Apollo crews had no off-the-planet company back in the 1960s and 1970s, the last time humanity set sail for deep space. We have been waiting for this like you can't imagine, Artemis II commander Reid Weissman called out. For Christina Koch on Artemis II and Jessica Mayer aboard the space station, it marked a joyous space reunion despite being 230,000 miles apart. The two teamed up for the world's first all-female spacewalk in 2019 outside the orbiting lab. Koch told her Astro sister that she hoped to meet up with her again in space, but I never thought it would be like this. It's amazing. I'm so happy that we are back in space together, Mayer replied, even if we are a few miles apart. Houston's Mission Control arranged the cosmic chit-chat between the four lunar travelers and the space station's three NASA and one French resident. Koch described being awestruck by not just the beauty of Earth, but how much blackness there was around it. It just made it even more special. It truly emphasized how alike we are, how the same thing keeps every single person on planet Earth alive, she told the space station crew. The specialness and preciousness of that really is emphasized when viewing the home planet from the moon. By late Tuesday afternoon, the Artemis II astronauts had beamed back more than 50 gigabytes worth of pictures and other data from the previous day's lunar rendezvous, which set a new distance record for humanity. The highlight, an Earth-set photo reminiscent of Apollo 8's Earthrise shot from 1968. While they are inspirational and I think allow all of us to really feel a little bit of what they were feeling, there is also a lot of science hidden inside of those images, said Mission Control's lead lunar scientist, Kelsey Young. The conversations and the science lessons learned are just beginning. During a debriefing with Young, the astronauts recounted how they spotted a cascade of pinpricks of light on the lunar surface from impacting cosmic debris. The flashes lasted mere milliseconds and coincided by chance with Monday evening's total solar eclipse. Young said it was too soon to know whether the crew witnessed an actual meteor shower or more random run-of-the-mill micrometeoroid hits. Either way, there were audible screams of delight in the Science Operations Center, she said. Koch described being awestruck by not just the beauty of Earth, but how much blackness was around it. The first lunar explorers since Apollo 17 in 1972, Wiseman and his crew are aiming for a splashdown off the San Diego coast on Friday to wrap up the nearly 10-day test flight. The recovery ship USS John Murtha left port Tuesday for the target zone. It sets the stage for next year's Artemis III, a lunar lander docking demo in orbit around Earth. Artemis IV will follow in 2028 with two astronauts attempting to land near the lunar south pole. As for the Orion's capsule's pesky potty, Mission Control assured the restaurant that no maintenance was required Tuesday. The toilet has been on and off limits to the crew ever since last week's launch, prompting them to rely on backup bag and funnel systems for urinating. NASA's administrator Jared Isaacman told the crew following the lunar flyby Monday night, "We definitely have to fix some of the plumbing ahead of the next Artemis mission." Engineers suspected a clogged filter and the overboard flushing system. Aside from the toilet and other relatively minor matters, the mission has gone well, Isaacman noted at a news conference Tuesday. But I'll breathe easier when we get through reentry and everybody's under chutes and in the water. Our next article is entitled, Rex Huerman Set to Plead Guilty in the Gilgo Beach Killings, Ending Long Search for Serial Killer. This has been written by Michael Sisak and Philip Marcello. A Long Island architect accused in a string of long, unsolved slayings known as the Gilgo Beach Killings is expected to plead guilty on Wednesday, closing a case that bedeviled investigators, agonized victims' relatives, and tantalized a true crime-obsessed public for years. Rex Huerman, 62, is charged with murdering seven women, many of them sex workers, over a 17-year span. A guilty plea would put him in prison for the rest of his life. His decision to plead guilty was confirmed by three people familiar with it. They spoke to the Associated Press on the condition of anonymity because the plea has yet to be entered in court. Huerman will be sentenced at a later date. Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney has scheduled a news conference for Wednesday afternoon following a morning court hearing. He will be joined by members of victims' families and of the Gilgo Beach Homicide Investigation Task Force, which cracked the case with the help of clues that included DNA lifted from a discarded pizza crust. A message seeking comment was left for Huerman's lawyer, Michael Brown. The Gilgo Beach investigation began in earnest in 2010 after police found numerous sets of human remains along a remote beach highway on Long Island's South Shore, setting off a search for a potential serial killer that attracted global interest and spawned a Hollywood movie. Investigators used DNA analysis and other evidence to identify victims. In some cases, they were able to connect them to remains found elsewhere on Long Island years earlier. Remains of six victims, Melissa Barthelemy, Maureen Buran Barnes, Amber Lynn Costello, Valerie Mack, Jessica Taylor, and Megan Waterman, were found in the scrub along Ocean Parkway near Gilgo Beach. The remains of another victim, Sandra Costilla, were found more than 60 miles away in the Hamptons. Police have also identified an eighth woman, Karen Vergata, whose remains were found on Fire Island more than 20 miles west in 1996 and near Gilgo Beach in 2011. Huerman has not been charged in Vergata's killing. But despite the attention, including a documentary series and a 2020 Netflix film, Lost Girls, the investigation dragged on for more than a decade, punctuated by fleeting leads and dashed hopes. In 2022, 6 weeks after a new police commissioner formed the Gilgo Beach Task Force, detectives identified Huerman as a suspect by using a vehicle registration database to connect him to a pickup truck that a witness reported seeing when one of the victims disappeared in 2010. Huerman lived for decades in Massapequa Park, about a 25-minute drive across a causeway spanning South Oyster Bay to the Sandy Stretch, where the woman's remains were found. Some of the victims were believed to have disappeared from that community, and their cell phones were found to have pinged towers in the area, authorities said. After the truck discovery, a grand jury authorized more than 300 subpoenas and search warrants, allowing the task force to dig into Huerman's life. Detectives collected billing records for burner phones he allegedly used to arrange meetings with the victims, retested DNA found with the bodies, and scoured Huerman's internet search history, which showed that he had viewed violent torture pornography and exhibited an intense interest in the Gilgo Beach killings and the renewed investigation. Cell phone data showed Huerman was in contact with some victims just before they disappeared, investigators said. To obtain Huerman's DNA, a task force surveillance team tailed him in Manhattan, where he worked, and watched as he threw the remnants of his lunch, a box of partially eaten pizza crusts, into a sidewalk garbage can. Investigators rushed in, grabbed the box, and sent it to the crime lab, which matched DNA from the crust to a male hair found on burlap used to restrain one of the victims. He was arrested in July of 2023. After Huerman's arrest, detectives spent more than 12 days searching his yard and home, where they found a basement vault that contained 279 weapons. On his computer, investigators said they found what they described as a blueprint for the killings, including a series of checklists with reminders to limit noise, clean the bodies, and destroy evidence. Last year, a judge rejected Huerman's bid to exclude DNA evidence obtained through advanced techniques that prosecutors say proves he's the killer. Our next article is entitled, Trial to Begin in Lawsuit Over Fatal Los Angeles Police Shooting of 14-Year-Old Girl in 2021. This has been written by Jamie Ding. A wrongful death lawsuit filed against the Los Angeles Police Department for an officer's fatal shooting of a 14-year-old girl in a clothing store is set to begin trial Wednesday. Valentina Orellana Peralta was shopping for Christmas clothes with her mother at a Burlington store in the San Fernando Valley's North Hollywood neighborhood on December 23rd of 2021 when she was struck by a bullet that had gone through the dressing room wall. Police were responding to calls for help after a man wielding a bike lock attacked two women in the building. As armed officers walked through the store, Officer William Dorsey Jones Jr. fired his rifle three times, killing the man and Orellana Peralta. The lawsuit filed by the girl's parents alleges wrongful death, negligence, and negligent infliction of emotional distress. Her mother, Soledad Peralta, felt her daughter's body go limp and watched helplessly as her daughter died while still in her arms, the lawsuit states. It alleges that the LAPD failed to adequately train and supervise the responding officers and fostered an environment that allowed and permitted the shooting to occur. Valentina had her entire life in front of her, and it was taken in an instant due to reckless decisions made by the very people who were sworn to protect her, said Nick Raleigh, who represents the family. We intend to hold LAPD fully accountable for taking an innocent young woman's life. The Los Angeles City Attorney's Office, representing the LAPD, did not immediately respond to an emailed request for comment. The Los Angeles Police Commission, a civilian oversight board, ruled in 2022 that Jones was justified in firing once, but that his two subsequent shots were out of policy. Then Police Chief Michael Moore previously found in his own review that all three shots were unjustified. Jones told the LAPD's use of force review board that he believed someone inside the store was shooting people and mistook the bike lock the man was wielding for a gun. He said he thought a wall behind the man backed up against an exterior brick wall when in fact the area contained the women's dressing rooms. Raleigh recently secured a $30 million settlement from the city of San Diego for the killing of a 16-year-old Kanoa Wilson, one of the largest settlements in a police killing case in U.S. history. It surpassed the $27 million settlement that the city of Minneapolis agreed to pay in the lawsuit over the killing of George Floyd. Our next article is entitled Route 66, a quintessential American road trip heavy on kitsch and history turns 100. This has been written by Susan Montoya Bryan. There are faster ways to get from Chicago to Los Angeles, but not have the allure or cultural cachet of Route 66. To John Steinbeck, it was the mother road that led poor farmers from Dust Bowl desperation to sunny California. To Native Americans along the route, it was an economic boon that also left scars. To black travelers, it offered sanctuary during segregation. And to music fans, it was a place to get their kicks. Route 66 marks its 100th anniversary this year. Despite losing its status decades ago as one of the nation's main arteries, people from around the world still flock to it to take perhaps the quintessential American road trip and soak in its neon lights, kitschy motels and attractions, and culinary offerings. Each town has its own history and magic, said Sebastian D. Border, a Dutch entrepreneur who, with his wife, breathed new life into the Aztec Motel in Seligman, Arizona. It's an essential part of American culture and history, he said of the highway. The historical aspect is just a very big, important part of American culture, with its influence and its character. Route 66, which runs for roughly 2,400 miles from Chicago through Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona, before ending in Santa Monica, California, was stitched together a century ago from a collection of Native American trading routes and old dirt roads, with the goal of linking the industrial Midwest to the Pacific Coast. Oklahoma businessman Cyrus Avery, known as the father of Route 66, saw it as more than just a way to cross the country efficiently. It was a chance to connect rural America and create new pockets of commerce. Avery knew the number 66 would be ripe for marketing and could be seared into drivers' minds, and he was right. Route 66 has been immortalized in movies, books, including Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath and Jack Kerouac's On the Road, and songs such as Bobby Troup's Get Your Kicks on Route 66, which served as an anthem for post-World War II optimism and mobility. Since its November 1926 designation as one of the nation's original numbered highways, one-time Main Street of America has embodied the promise of prosperity. It became a literal path of hope for migrants, escaping drought-ravaged farms and poverty during the 1930s Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. And during World War II, it was used to move troops, equipment, and workers out west. The post-war boom of the 1940s and 50s were Route 66 heyday, as it became a popular vacation route. Cars became more affordable, disposable income increased, and people began chasing freedom on the open road. People generally have a sense of adventure, a sense of curiosity, and you can find that on Route 66. This is the road of dreams, author and historian Jim Hinckley said. Roadside diners and motels thrived as crafty entrepreneurs dreamed up ways to part motorists from their money. There were rattlesnake pits, totem poles, trading posts, caverns where Old West outlaws purportedly hung out, and modern engineering marvels like St. Louis's gleaming steel arch. Barns were painted with larger-than-life ads, Billboards teased local attractions and neon was everywhere. The cherry on top, the food. There were places to grab and go, but also to sit down and relish a slice of home. The Cozy Dog Drive-In, famous for its breaded hot dogs on a stick, has fit both bills since 1949. Inside the dining room in Springfield, Illinois, travelers tell tales of life on the highway. The road wouldn't be alive without the stories of all the places along it that kept it going from town to town. Third-generation owner Josh Waldermeyer said, "We just survive off each other. The road feeds us, and as long as we put our feelings and love back into the road, it will reverberate with the travelers and the stories of the people." Route 66 was an economic boon to the Native American tribes along the way, but although it brought tourists, it also left scars of eminent domain across tribal land and perpetuated stereotypes. More than half of the highway crossed through Indian country, and vendor signs often made casual references to teepees and feathered headdresses, symbols easily appropriated for marketing, but not always representative of the distinctive cultures found along the route. At Laguna Pueblo, west of Albuquerque, restaurants and service stations sprang up, some operated by military veterans from the Pueblo who were masters at fixing everything, from flat tires to busted radiators. Pueblo women adapted, too, turning utilitarian pottery vessels into works of art coveted by tourists. Homemade bread and pies sealed the deal. Laguna leaders have long considered the road, or Hiyani in the tribe language of Keres, as the corridor of commerce, said businessman and tribal member Ron Solomon. Capitalizing on that potential, the tribe has built a multi-million-dollar empire of casinos, burger stands, and other businesses. There were also dangers along the route, particularly during the Jim Crow era, when black travelers had to rely on guides like the Green Book to find safe lodging and services. Especially for long-distance travel, segregation was a fact of life, said Matthew Pierce, state historian for the Oklahoma Historical Society. And so black motorists needed to know a safe place to go. The Thiriat filling station near the central Oklahoma community of Luther wasn't listed in the Green Book, but it did serve as a safe haven between two sundown towns where people who weren't white needed to leave by sunset. The station offered barbecue and even baseball. Edward Thiriat, whose grandparents opened the station around 1933, recalled a TV program about travelers getting their kicks on 66. "By and large, the black traveler didn't get a lot of kicks on Route 66," he said. "And if they got some kicks, it wasn't the kind that you would think of." More than 90% of the road is still drivable in California. Cadillac Ranch in the Texas Panhandle offers the chance to spray paint half-buried cars. And at the Mississippi River, travelers can walk or bike across the old chain of Rocks Bridge. More than 250 of the route's buildings, districts, and road segments are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. But it's more than bricks and asphalt that fuel the fascination. Some of the most interesting things and fun things that happen to people when they travel the route is running into somebody they know or some happenstance thing that comes totally unexpected, said author and historian Jim Ross. And that's a great part of the Route 66 experience. Well, that concludes our time. Until next time, and thank you for listening.